The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program James Lee Burke. He joins us on the telephone in Montana. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Vic. How you doing?
So good to hear your voice, Jim.
Same here.
You've got a new novel coming out here real soon. We're going to run this interview right after it comes out. It's called Another Kind of Eden. You're writing about the Holland family again.
Yeah.
This is your mother's family, right?
Correct. My grandmother was a Holland, and the patriarch of the family was a old former Confederate soldier and drover and rode the Chisholm Trail and a gunman, and he shot and killed 9 men, and he became a Baptist saddle preacher. Sam Morgan Holland was his name. So I've written quite a bit about them. The Holland books are the best book I have written is Wayfaring Stranger. Nothing I've written comes anywhere close to the, I think, the quality of the book as Wayfaring Stranger. It's just, I've never understood really by how it just kind of got published and disappeared. But that book, which is a Holland book, deals with the Depression and Bonnie and Clyde in World War II and the post-war years and the oil business. That and House of the Rising Sun, also a Holland book, and The Jealous Kind. Those three books, as a trilogy, are the best work I've written.
Your narrator in the new novel, Another Kind of Eden, Aaron Holland Broussard, he's got some anger.
Yeah, he does, but it's of the right kind. He's a really good protagonist. He is also the protagonist in the Holland novel, The Jealous Kind, takes place in 1952. The rock and roll era rewritten. But I think it's really a very good book, and I believe it's an honest portrayal of the 1950s. Most books that treat the 50s are not, I think, accurate. The only two works, either filmic or literary, that I believe are accurate were both written by the same man. The book was called The Amboy Dukes. It's about the white street gangs of the 50s. The 50s was a violent era. It had many, you know, things that we are nostalgic for today, and rightly so. But it was also, you know, the McCarthy era and the Korean War and, you know, the beginnings of the civil rights movement and the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. This kind of bad time. Yeah.
I remember in the Jealous Kind, it was mostly set in Texas, in Houston and some in Galveston, and lots of cars, lots of fancy 1950s souped-up cars.
That's it. Actually, teenage Americans changed the entire car industry. It was they who remodeled the cars, literally. They put split manifolds on them, dual exhaust, milled heads, hot cams, and big carburetors, those double carburetors, and Lordy, you know, and they put drop Merc engines on Ford frames. But that was the 50s. The kids were actually very innovative. Of course, these same kind of guys were pretty rough guys, too.
Mm.
They weren't like, what's his name, Fonzie? Not like Fonzie.
Did you have a car you really loved back then?
No, No, I didn't. We didn't own a car until I was in high school.
Uh-huh.
It was a very different look. Television actually had a huge influence on the civil rights movement, but not in the way people think. It showed a middle-class America that really didn't exist. You know, the beaver cleaver culture,
uh-huh.
Beautiful homes, you know, in some suburb outside of Los Angeles. Most ordinary people didn't live in houses like that. They just got by. You know, but people of color in the suburbs saw Beaver Cleaver's world and decided, you know, they deserved better.
Mm.
But I think almost all sociologists agree that was the big change. But it was the fantasy, in other words, the fantasy that was portrayed to us was kind of a trick on white America as well as black America. Look, put it this way, Whitey has many manifestations. The man I call Whitey is the fellow sitting up on the veranda of the big house on the top of the hill, drinking a mint julep. This is an expression, you know, in the South, there used to be. We all pick the white man's cotton. It's Whitey up there on the veranda with his feet on the rail.
Yeah.
Hey, did you ever read or see John Grisham's The Chamber?
I have not.
This Klansman, played by Gene Hackman, is about to be put to death. And the warden says, "Bill, we got to do it. Do you have anything to say?" And Hackman's character says, "Yes, sir, I do have something to say. In my life, I hated many people, and the one I hated the most was myself." What a line. John should have gotten a Pulitzer Prize for that line alone.
Mm.
That says it all. This poor fellow was taught to hate himself and to blame the black man for his problems. That's what it's always been about.
Well,
always. It has never changed.
Yeah. Like you, he grew up in the South, so he saw all that.
John, yeah.
Yeah.
He's a real gentleman. He's a very nice fellow.
You're listening to WYSO, amplifying voices from every corner of our community, and I'll continue my conversation with James Lee Burke right after this. My guest is James Lee Burke. His new novel is Another Kind of Eden, and anyone who reads this novel is going to see the word Ludlow throughout the novel, and some readers are going to wonder what Ludlow was. Can you tell them?
Well, Ludlow was a place down there just north of Trinidad, Colorado, on the southern Colorado Plateau. It was a mining area, and the mine workers, United Mine Workers there, went on strike. And John Rockefeller was one of the owners of the mining company. There were several of them. He was a big player. Well, his goons killed a lot of people. They killed 11 women and children. They were suffocated in a cellar. But that cellar is still there. I've been down in it several times. But that's the way it was. That's, you know, Molly Brown, you know, Unsinkable Molly.
She ended up at Ludlow, right?
That's right. Yeah. Her husband was part of the coalition that owned the mine.
Mm-hmm.
But she marched with the miners. She was heck on wheels.
Mm.
And one of the few people who behaved bravely when the Titanic went down. You know, another one who behaved very bravely was John... begins with an Astor. John, was it John Astor? When the deck was awash, he asked the band to play "God, My God, Closer to Thee," and he lit a cigarette with his lighter and put his wife in the lifeboat, stayed on deck himself, and said, "Oh, we'll see you on a better day, my darling girl.
Oh, my.
Ah, that's class. Because most people there did not behave well on the Titanic. It was study and shame, really. The Irish were, they were kept down in lower decks. The doors, the ports were locked. And, oh, jeez, the hatches were locked. And, yuck.
They never treated the Irish very well, did they?
And, no, they didn't. Boy, the coffin ships. My ancestors came over on the coffin ships.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, most of us who, you know, who have any Irish background, you know, it's, boy, they had a bad time, and then they were used really as mercenaries and badly paid mercenaries in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see the film, oh golly, it's a great story about the Irish in the Lower East Side. DiCaprio played in it.
The Gangs of New York?
Yes, that. Wow, what a film.
Uh-huh.
Kind of cleaned up the Irish because, you know, they did some really bad stuff in the draft riots of 1863.
Mm-hmm. Your protagonist in this novel, Aaron Holland Broussard, he has a love interest, Joanne McDuffie, and she isn't very interested in the Ludlow thing. She is inspired to do her artwork about Ludlow. Do you want to talk about her at all?
Yeah, well, she's a really great character. She's a young woman, a waitress. And she's an orphaned and working in a Mexican restaurant here in Trinidad, Colorado, and Aaron Holland falls in love with her. But she's also a painter, and she's painted a tribute to the suffering of the poor people who were murdered there in 1914 at Ludlow, Colorado. And she's taken in by an art professor, a truly vile man who's part of the drug culture. And this is what the book is about. The book is set in the fall of 1962, just a few weeks prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis. That week of the missile crisis was the most dangerous in human history.
Mm.
We came within 2 hours of a nuclear war. 3 weeks later, when the episode had passed, John Kennedy addressed the nation. Nobody ever looks at that tape. This is what he said. He said, in the first month after a nuclear war, he called it thermonuclear exchange, 185 million Americans would have died. A terrible death. Then he added, victory would have been ashes in our mouth. Hmm. What scares you is that he rolled the dice anyway, and it was not a defensive or military move. It was political.
Uh-huh.
He was a great man, right, but not on this one. Not in my view. That was a terrible mistake. I mean, God must have intervened. Because there were some real madmen at work in the White House. And the ones that used caution and wisdom were Robert Kennedy and Adlai Stevenson.
Mm-hmm. And Adlai, of course, twice was defeated by Eisenhower in 1952 and 1956 for the presidency. My dad was an Adlai guy all the way.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was Stevenson was really a great man. He was just too gentle and genteel that people wanted a, you know, a more aggressive person. And Ike Eisenhower was a great man. You know, he waved to me twice in one day in London in August of 1959.
Huh.
That's a fact. I was standing I was a graduate student at the time, and I was standing in front of St. Paul's Cathedral, just a tourist, and this open Rolls-Royce, it was a Rolls-Royce with no type, top, pulled in right beside me with Dwight Eisenhower and Prime Minister McMillan in the back seat. And Ike was standing up, and there was a pub on the other side of the street. It was midday, and people, you could hear this gasp, and all of these working men came out of the pub, and one of them was plastered out of his head, and he came right for Eisenhower. And Ike raised his hands and then stretched out and held the man's hands, both hands, and the drunk man said, "Ike, I was there with you at Sword Beach. We whipped Jerry's ass, didn't we?" And Ike said, "How you doing there, Tommy?" and shook both of his hands. Prime Minister McMillan looked like sewer gas had been released in his face. He looked horrified. The difference between the patrician and Ike, the man of the people. Anyway, that was midday. That same day, later on that night, I went to see the West Side Story in Piccadilly, and after the play, I was walking home to St. James Plaza. There was nobody on the street. Here came that same Dad Byrne Rolls-Royce again, but the top was on it. Ike's back window was down. Nobody else was on the street, and I waved my hand, and he stuck his hand and his whole shoulder out the window and waved to me. What are the odds of that happening twice in one day with no planning? I didn't even know Eisenhower was visiting the city.
Oh, I never heard that story before, Jim.
It's a great story, and I'll never forget it. But the thing is, golly, Moses, that was Ike Eisenhower, though. He was always called the soldier, you know, because he was a very decent and good man.
I remember he was asked one time what he thought about his vice president's work, what he thought Dick Nixon had done, and to paraphrase, he said something like, "Well, if you give me a while," he says, "maybe I can think of something."
No, I said a week. He said, "Give me a week and I'll get back to you." He hated Nixon.
Right.
Tried not to use his name.
Yeah. Well, you have his name in your book, Another Kind of Eden. There, his picture is on the wall in somebody's place.
Is it?
Yeah.
I forget that scene. It's not a good, it's not complimentary.
Yeah. Right. Strom Thurmond.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nixon, Billy Graham, and Strom Thurmond are hanging in this man's house.
Right. Yeah. That's it.
I had breakfast with Strom Thurmond.
Uh-huh.
That's a fact, 1981. The man was just crazy as a blue jay in a mulberry tree.
Yeah. And that's... Speaking of villains, Jim, you have some great villains, as always, in your new novel, Another Kind of Eden. But I sure do miss Smiley. Are we ever going to see Smiley again? You never actually killed him off, did you?
Well, Smiley is one of these guys that has a way of coming back.
Okay. All right.
He is the best villain I've ever created.
Okay.
I love Smiley. In fact, we were going to make smiley buttons,
right?
And with a smiley face, but with the caption underneath, "Smiley is coming to your city soon."
Right. I would love to have one of those.
Oh, geez, he's a great character.
Now, Jim, if you had to give our listeners just a brief capsule, what is Another Kind of Eden about? What is the story about?
It's about today. It's not about 1962. You remember what Faulkner said, the past is not the past, it's not even the past. That, in effect, this is my view, the changes of the country, the big ones that have, for good or bad, marked the era in which we live today, had their inception with the year 1962.
Oh.
So in this book, we see the beginnings of the drug culture, this bus full of what people call beatniks back then. But this bus arrives, and of course, there's some really insidious people on board. Most of them are victims, but they're the orphans of America who made up the Charles Manson family. But Manson, this Manson story is not about Manson. It's about America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Haight-Ashbury is just a giant open-air orphanage. But secondly, it's about the class war, and we're still involved in it. We're in the heart of it. Another idea, I think, in this book, and it's not actually anything that I came up with, I think it's obvious, is the fact we are still involved with the American Civil War. It's still here. It's still going. The same engines are at work, the same people, the same economics.
Mm.
And also the war between the states had its inception with the what was called the Native or Know-Nothing Party of the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where we are today, except more frighteningly, because it's not geographical anymore. It's ideological, and it's from coast to coast. It's here. It's real. There are a large number of self-benighted people who are willing to turn over their common sense, their rationality, and put their lives, their destiny, everything that is dear to them in the hands of iniquitous men.
Mm. Okay. Well,
that's it. I had breakfast with Strom Thurmond.
Mm-hmm.
I did so as penance because I sold barbecue tickets for him in 1948 door to door for a political rally. I was only 11 years old, but I still felt guilty. And so I went to this breakfast for him at a university where I was teaching. And this is 1981 when Senator Thurmond, you know, he sent four men to the electric chair. One was a 17-year-old black kid who may have acted in self-defense. But anyway, he was the symbol of segregation. He also was the man who forced Nixon to put Agnew on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was sitting not just very close to me, and he seemed he was also the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was a very powerful man. Now, you are a journalist, and I have worked as a journalist as well. And I've always believed that the Antichrist is out there somewhere in the form of a politician. Well, as we both have discovered, when we expect to meet Satan, we end up talking to Elmer Fudd. It's like talking to an empty closet with moths in it. Anyway, Senator Thurmond was criticizing, at least as I remember, people who were on welfare and the media and welfare. I'm shocked that he would talk about media and welfare people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so this is a literal quote. Okay, ready?
Yeah.
Why the media, they obsessive. When John Kennedy was killed, that's all they talked about for days. For days. That's a literal quote. I turned this man next to me and I said, did he just say that? And my friend next to me said, yep, he sure did. This is what I mean. They say, you don't get Machiavelli, you get Bugs Bunny. How can you be even angry at somebody like that?
Well, Okay. I heard a rumor from Otto Penzler that you are in a new story collection he's putting out at the Mysterious Bookshop. You got a new short story. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it. It's my favorite short story. It is undoubtedly my best short story. Its title is Harbor Lights, and it's about the sinking of ships right off of the Louisiana coast in the early days of World War II. But it's a great short story. I will always be proud of everything I've written because it was the best I could do at the time. But Wayfaring Stranger is an exceptional book, and this short story is exceptional. It's as good as I can write. I just cannot write better than that. But it's one of those that it's a peculiar thing that occurs in my own art, that I don't remember what I write. I don't remember it at all. It's as though someone else has written it. And I have non-chemically induced blackouts. And it's always been that way. I've never known where the story comes from, and I don't remember it when it's finished. But this is one of those that this story and the story Wayfaring Stranger, the words to describe them, I have to borrow from Faulkner and Hemingway, and I don't compare myself with them. That's not the point. It's what they said, both of them, right before their deaths. Faulkner was sick with, you know, heart disease and exacerbated by his alcoholism. But he said, "Had I not written the books, another hand would have written them for me." And right before Hemingway's death at Sun Valley, Idaho, he said something very similar. He said, "When I went back and reread The Old Man and the Sea, it was though it had been written by another hand." Mm-hmm. And Ernest Hemingway did not have a lot of humility about his success. I knew the family, and I was friends with Lester and Miss Doris. They really were great people. But Hemingway had a votive connection with his own work. I think that he was a far more religious man than people thought, but his religion was inside a chapel of his own, and that somebody once said that his best book was For Whom the Bell Tolls, because in effect the Spanish people were his church, that they themselves were almost like a holy creation. And you know, he talks about that. Actually, Robert Jordan talks about that, how they're like dangerous children. They're innocent in their way, but they're also capable of creating the Spanish Inquisition.
Mm. Well, you've turned me on to so many great books, Jim, over the years. I recently discovered another Montana writer I hadn't read, James Crumley. Did you ever know him?
Oh, gee, very well. Many years. Met him at Iowa in 1965.
He must have been a real character.
Well, Jim was very talented, and he had a very good heart, and he died too young.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I've been reading some of his stuff, and wow, pretty wild books.
Jim had a raw talent that was just among the greatest of his generation.
Well, I kind of figured you might have known him.
The first novel, One to Count Cadence.
I have not read that one.
Let's see, golly Moses. But there are instances in there of just some of the best writing that was ever done about war, and particularly the Indo-Chinese involvement. But it was just Jim's, I don't want to say say more. Just Jim's power as a writer was just everyone knew it. Everyone knew it. Just the guy was a titan, and it was, you know, Jim died young.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he certainly had an ear for dialogue.
Oh, Jim was great at dialogue.
And
he was great at just telling stories.
Uh-huh.
Jim was a good story. He knew how to tell a story. You know, a lot of people have forgotten that, that we are supposedly descendants as artists of Homer, and Homer was a great storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, I know we've run past our clock here, and I should let you go, but it's just such a treat to talk to you again. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, and can you tell me when we click off the tape?
I'll do that, Jim. My guest has been James Lee Burke, and his new one is Another Kind of Eden. You heard about it on the Book Nook, and you've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO with my guest James Lee Burke. And we recorded that interview a few weeks ago. His book just came out this week. And Jim, at the end of our conversation, he wanted to talk about his friend James Crumley, but he wanted to do that privately. He didn't want that on the radio. So that's why he asked me if we were ready to turn off the tape recorder. That was my 20th interview with James Lee Burke. I've got a Book Nook bonus coming your way right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. We've got a little extra time on the show this morning, and we're going to dip into our archive and go back to an interview that I revisited last weekend with Boston Turan, recorded in 1999. He had written a novel called God is a Bullet, his first novel, and what a book. Let's listen now to Boston Turan talking about a book that is finally being turned into a major motion picture. On the Book Nook.
Many people were shocked at first that I guess a mainstream publisher picked it up. But I think from the amount of emails I get and things, that's what makes the difference. What seems shocking to people in the publishing world when I get the emails is so right down the middle of the road of what's in people's hearts. So many women email me telling me, you know, I have been through all, you know, I'm using their words now, you know, I've been through all kinds of difficult emotional experiences where I have been abused and maligned in all kinds of physical and psychological ways. I can relate to the heroine in this book because she slowly, methodically, and fiercely climbs out of that to retake everything she may have lost. They can really feel that, and even though you put it in this very bizarre background, into the world of, you know, the Mojave Desert and Satanism and all these other kinds of hugely dark and ferocious story, all the other elements of life they can really attach to and experience on the human element. And after all, ultimately that's what books are, the human element.
Well, I found myself questioning my own moral values and yet feeling them validated.
It's an interesting exercise, isn't it? I, when I was doing the book, sometimes some of the people who were reading the other parts of the other manuscript said, should we root for these people, some of these secondary and tertiary characters? Do we like them or do we hate them? I said, I really don't know. They're just real. Uh-huh. They're just people who are doing certain things and living a life. It's difficult. Sometimes the people you like the most are not pitiable, and sometimes the people you hate the most have a huge amount of pity drawn out of them, and it brings up all those contrary feelings. And that's good, because the truth about violence is, if we cannot deal with it within ourselves, you know, we cannot expect, you know, if you cannot come to grips and encompass it within yourself, it becomes impossible to evaluate it in the world around you and say, why?
Well, I really hate to mention this, but I'm guessing that Hollywood must be sniffing around the edge of this one.
Hollywood, absolutely. They have... There have been a number of companies that have been on it for a long, long time, but I still am in somewhat of a quandary whether it's entirely a good idea or not.
Whether they could do it justice. Who would they cast as Cyrus, for instance? That would be a tough one.
I have asked this question, and I'm waiting to find an answer somewhere. Is it always to the long-term benefit of the book that a movie is made at all. Is sometimes that a good idea? I mean, sometimes great movies are made from books, and I guess it popularizes them. Do people then read the book throughout the years after that? Or do people always go back to the movie? And if the book ruins the movie, how many of us have been in restaurants where you hear the conversation at the next table where somebody said, boy, did you see that movie? It really stunk. And somebody says, but you should read the book. It was a great book. And the person says, well, what do I want to read the book for? I already know the plot, and the movie stinks. And so I have my own quandaries about this in terms of a book. You know, a movie has its own life and its own identity when it's just a movie. But when it comes from a book, I just don't know.
Yeah, you have your idea of how this looks, and there's no way they can get in your head and copy that.
Well, yeah, even beyond that, there are talented people who can do all kinds of things and maybe do it justice and or do it better. I'm more concerned that, you know, somewhere down the road, people want to read the book and be moved by the book. Not that it made a great movie and that people could go see a great movie off of a book they may not remember or may not want to read.
Boston Turan has joined us. His book is God is a Bullet. Boston, I had the advantage of actually having one extra sheet of paper of information sent by your publicist, which actually had a quote from you and a little bit more information than we have in the book. And it alludes to the fact that some of your family members had rather interesting lives and that this gave you some of the inspiration for the book.
Yes, that's exactly true. My family were notoriously shifty, would be a polite way of dealing with it. They were into all kinds of cons. They were gamblers. They ran all kinds of bookie syndicates. And if they got in trouble, they were not adverse to changing their life and lifestyles enough to successfully keep on going.
Well, I think we can look at a lot of families and see this has occurred. Not everyone can say that they have these wonderful Puritan backgrounds. I can remember my dad bragging about being involved in the numbers racket in Chicago back in the 30s, so may he rest in peace.
Yeah.
Yes. We also have the character of Case, who you can't get over her strength in this thing. You keep doubting her, and she keeps coming back, and you just fall in love with her as a reader. Yet she's the kind of person, if you saw her on the street, you'd probably shy away from her.
I think that was the classic. That was exactly true. That was exactly when you. That became the bone of really what the book was about. That you take a, because you see her through the eyes of a very straight world, good and bad. I mean, the small town sheriff is a decent man who has been raised on all the decent values. Who is trying to, by the way, live by them in some rugged, broken fashion, trying to hold on to all that. And here he's asked to sit across from the table and have to entrust his life to this human being who, if he did see her walking down the street, he would have nothing positive to say about her, nothing positive to feel about her, and by the end, he cannot go beyond or without her. So it becomes the fascinating turn of how much of what we always call the other, that classic enemy that we make up in our minds, how much of them do we really, really need to integrate into our own lives to be whole and human and successful? You know, it's just so easy to always walk down the street and say, well, you know, our group is fine, but, you know, the others, you know how they really are, right?
Now, you actually talked to some cult members, or were they former cult members, with this left-handed path?
These were two kids. It was the kid who had the broken leg.
Okay.
And he was also waiting for his girlfriend. And she had also split from the cult, but she had stayed in the United States in hiding. She was going to meet him there, and they were going to start a new life. They actually have a new identities now. They live a very quiet life on a very unimposing block, and they have a baby, and no one knows about their background. And they had run around for a couple of years. They were at the time 19, and they were not, they're 19 and 18. So they had been, they've been doing it since they were 16, tramping around. They had both, one came from a very standard middle-class family, the other one came from actually a very, very good upper-middle-class family.
Would they have some distinguishing tattoos that someone in the know might recognize?
They would, but they were working on, they had a lot of tattoos. They were getting some of them taken off, some of the distinguishing ones, some of the others they kept. They would look now, if you saw them, they would not look much different than most teenagers walking around, or most, a lot of kids in their 20s. Go into lots of shops, decent shops, stores, supermarkets, young executives, they roll up their sleeves, you see they've got them on the back of their neck, on their legs, you see very nice women walking around in high heel shoes and stockings, and you can see they've got tattoos. They would fit right in. A few of them would have been classic markings, but they're gone now.
Well, with the proliferation of tattoos here in the last 10 years or so, I really just take them for granted. But having read your book, now I'm going to look more closely.
It's interesting because there is a whole world that has since, and if I don't know if you know, do you follow? If you go to any good newsstand, you will see what used to be, if there was never a tattoo magazine. Now there are huge numbers of them, of all kinds. And they even have, there's a whole subculture of people who are into Jesus and everything, and Christian, and they have their whole subculture of tattoos and all that stuff. And it's all built on that idea. So even in that small environment, everything starts to duplicate itself. You've got pro one life, pro a different life. You've got one viewpoint and the opposite viewpoint. And very soon, even in tattoos, it starts to, the lines begin to demarc themselves into the other. I am, you are. And otherness builds separateness, and separateness ultimately means somebody's got to be better than somebody else. Somebody's got to be on top. Somebody has to have the pure thought and the more powerful idea.
We're just seeing more and more hybrids. We have the Christian motorcycle gangs, just all kinds of mixtures of beliefs coming together that you never would have believed 20 years ago. My guest is Boston Turan. His book is God is a Bullet.
I think there was groups like that a long time ago. I think they called them the Knights Templar, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Somebody once said to me, you know, cult killings really seem to have started in the United States. And we were talking back and forth, and ultimately I said, are you sure? And the person said to me, you know, now that I really think about it, I'm not sure. You know, the Crusades might have qualified as a cult killing, but on a large scale.
I would have to agree with that.
Because they were both considered cults. I mean, you know, Christianity was considered a cult. I mean, all religions were considered cults. Eventually, the two largest cults of the world met and tried to fight it out for territory, so possible.
Well, when you mentioned the Columbine killings earlier, it struck me that the cult killing that takes place in this book is in a suburb that might be somewhat like Littleton. We think about these big suburbs and apparently some of the empty lives out there that turn to violence. I made the connection when you mentioned Columbine. I hadn't thought of it.
I think you see it exactly so as you say it. It is an emotional emptiness that cannot be, that suburbia cannot fill. Wealth doesn't fill it. Prestige doesn't fill it. There's a void that starts to happen into people that only a really working at it, becoming a centered human being and really dealing with all the dark aspects of yourself are a full-time job. And then you can take a world around you that may not live up to your expectations. You know, so many people, the world doesn't live up to their expectations. I'm not sure the world is supposed to. I think you just have to live up to your own expectations.
And as we create these suburbs and we sprawl out and develop and develop and develop, we are disturbing the bones of ancient people.
Well, it's been done and will be. And as long as you keep repeating that process, if nothing, it's very difficult to How do you if the world and life around you is not ultimately sacred in some fashion, how do you have value? It's hard for, here's where people get into that otherness. Well, you know, everything else has no value, but I do. It's a hard line to hold because you're then caught with the trap. The trap is, it's not working. There's a gap in between what I'm seeing and what I'm saying. You know, I'm the good one, but the rest, you know, what the heck about it? We don't care about any of this. We don't care about the land. We don't care about anything about people. We don't care about other things. As long as I'm okay, as long as people respect me, as long as people think better of me than I think of them, life is great. But the gap widens. It gets very difficult. I think we all certainly feel it.
Well, I must say, reading God is a Bullet and watching the transformation of Bob, the good cop, what was really enjoyable, just to see him change throughout the book and what he becomes, you really wonder where it's all going to end, and it's a great ride.
Thank you very much.
It was worth every page. I got to the last page, and the plane was just landing, and I just stopped and just went blank for about 5 minutes, and that doesn't happen too often with a book.
Well, I appreciate that. I really do.
That was Boston Turan, recorded back in 1999, talking about his first novel, God is a Bullet. And that went on to be nominated for the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Award the following year for Best First Novel. And during that conversation, we talked about whether it would ever be turned into a movie. And it's taken 22 years for them to do that. Last week, they wrapped up shooting the film For God is a Bullet in New Mexico. It's going to be a major release in movie theaters once they get that all put together. And he also didn't know in that conversation whether he'd be writing any more books. Well, I looked him up on Wikipedia, and all it says is Boston Turan is the pseudonymous American author of 13 novels. So he did go on and write more, and he just published one just last month. It's called Two Boys at Breakwater. I don't know if he's one person, if he's many people. He's very mysterious, is Boston Turan. And I'm looking forward to seeing that movie because it's a tremendous book, and I'm wondering if they'll be able to do it justice. It took them all these years to get it on the big screen, 22 years, and I've never had another opportunity to interview him. And he's a mystery all these years later, 22 years later, nobody knows who he is. Some people believe that it's a consortium of writers that actually write under the name Boston Turan. Some people believe that it's top secret because some of these writers are famous and they don't want us to know who they are. This is all conjecture. And I am fascinated by the whole thing and the fact that I was able to get an interview with him. And all these years later, still, I don't know who this guy was. He did have a Bronx accent. He did have a very definite way of speaking. And I'm just intrigued by all that. And if you're into listening to authors talk about their work, you can listen to all kinds of interviews in our Book Nook archive at wyso.org. We have over 700 interviews archived. That's hundreds and hundreds of hours of conversations with authors going back to 1994. You can listen to them at your leisure at wyso.org anytime you want. And we appreciate those of you who check out the archive. I think you'll find some very interesting things in there if you've never looked at it. That's wyso.org, our Book Nook pages, over 700 interviews. That's a lot of reading. That's a lot of books. That's a stack of authors. And we do it because we know that you enjoy it. Thanks, as always, for listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, which comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock and every Sunday morning at 10:30. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.